Are you a genetic counselor, genetic counseling student, or someone that wants to learn more about genetics? Then I recommend this workshop next week on August 11th. For over 4 hours, you will hear from genetic professionals from around the world about different areas of genetic counseling. I'm excited to be one of the presenters covering prenatal genetic counseling. Other colleagues are sharing their expertise on precision medicine, ethical issues, adult genetic counseling, cancer genetic counseling, and laboratory technologies. You can join us in this collaborative worldwide workshop next week on August 11th. Here's how to register. You can use the link in the show notes, which is available if you're listening to this in a podcast player, just to swipe. And you can also access it via our website, dnapodcast.com. Just look out for the blog post for this episode, and the link will be in there for this webinar. Again, it's on August 11th. Looking forward to connecting with you all there.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening or watching DNA Today. We are a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Deneen, and I'm also a prenatal genetic counselor. On this show, we explore genetics' impact on our health through conversations with leaders in genetics. These are genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, researchers, and many, many more people. My guest today is Dr. Dayan Goodnow. He is the founder and CEO of Prodrome Sciences. In this episode, we're going to be talking about dementia, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and what we know about biomarkers and the genetic predispositions for these conditions. So we're diving into all this today. So Dr. Goodnow, thank you so much for coming on the show. Your book just came out, For Breaking Alzheimer's is the name of it. So thank you so much for coming on and exploring all of these topics with us today.
Well, thank you, Kira. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So I thought we could start out with making sure everybody understands the relationship with dementia and Alzheimer's disease, because it's not necessarily the same thing. So I wanted to make sure that everybody understands this background information before we get into all the biomarkers and the genetic predispositions. So how are these two related? How are they different?
Well, that's a really good question. Now, Alzheimer's, as we currently understand it, was discovered by a doctor, Alois Alzheimer, by in the early 10 or 15 in that range. And it was really related to pre-senile dementia. Okay, he had a patient who had dementia and she was young. And after she died, he did a neuropathological analysis and he discovered that there was these amyloid plaques in between the neurons and there were neurofibrillary tangles within the neurons. So this became called Alzheimer's disease. And Alzheimer's was considered a type of pre-senile dementia. At the time, people thought senile dementia, which was more common, obviously, was more related to cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis. And then you fast forward around 50 years or so, then in the 1960s, people were looking at people that were dying, post-mortem analysis of with Alzheimer's, with dementia, and they were recognizing, hey, these older people have similar pathological formations in their brain as classical Alzheimer's. And so then they created a subclass of dementia called dementia of the Alzheimer's type, or late on-stage dementia. And then as time goes on, there's really four types of dementia. There's the Alzheimer's type, there's the vascular dementia, frontotemporal lobe dementia, Lewy body dementia. So dementia is a reduction in cognitive functioning. And then when you subclassify it, it's kind of saying, okay, what type of dementia? How do I characterize this particular patient? And most of the time, that's been done post-mortem. So we don't necessarily know what the actual characterization of that dementia patient is until post-mortem. We're getting better and better now with symptomology and with better technology. We can diagnose the type of dementia pre-death much more accurately than we ever used to be able to. But that's still most of a classification scheme. It's not really a causation scheme. Now, we've known what causes dementia since the 70s, and it's cholinergic neuron dysfunction. Okay, that's absolute. And the very first drug ever approved for Alzheimer's was a drug that improved cholinergic function in the brain. So dementia, at the biochemical perspective, is reduced transmission of cholinergic neurons. whereas Parkinson's is the reduced transmission of dopamine neurons. And then people have, you know, anxiety and depression are typically serotonergic or noradrenergic systems. You know, epilepsy will have different neurotransmitter systems of the brain that get fundamentally impaired. But that's the proximate. So dementia is a physiological dysfunction of the cholinergic neuron system. Then we can ask the question, well, where is this coming from? And that is where you get into much more of a heated debate as to what is causing these cholinergic neurons to lose their function. And they shrink. They don't actually die right away. Like in the main cell body for these cholinergic neurons is called the nucleus basalis. And they project, the cell bodies are in like the deep brain, and then they project their axons up into the cortical regions and the hippocampus and so on. And that's, it's their axon terminals where we see the dysfunction. But quite often the neurons actually shrink. They don't actually die. And so they're still there. They're just kind of inactivated. And that's kind of where, you know, there's a lot of actually hope in terms of the Alzheimer's or dementia part of this world. So that's what's kind of gone on over time. People have, in the late 1990s or early 1990s, they discovered this amyloid plaque, and they actually were able to sequence a protein, A-beta-1, you know, peptide 1 through 42. And that changed the whole world. And it kind of coincided with the whole genomics revolution of gene sequencing, gene chip formation. And it was, the whole world was really abuzz. A lot of things were changing right then. We were doing large-scale biology where we'd sequence all the genes, or we look at all the gene transcripts simultaneously, and we'd say, okay, what's going on here? And then that kind of created this whole focus on genes, and then the gene product, which are the transcripts, like gene chips, and then those transcripts get converted to proteins, so the proteomics part. And all of that comes directly from your genome.
Curious about your own genetic risk for Parkinson's disease? Picture Genetics' newest DNA testing kit, Picture PDAware, is designed for you. There is a 4-9% higher risk of developing the disease if you have a family history of it. So Picture PDAware is for anyone who wants to assess the genetic risk for developing Parkinson's disease. Picture Genetics is working in collaboration with the Parkinson's Foundation and the PD Generation Study to make it easier for you to find out your risk for Parkinson's disease. This is by providing you with knowledge and tools you need now to plan for the years ahead. This includes genetic counseling with your Picture PDAware kit, so you're fully supported and educated about what the results mean for you and your family. Visit picturegenetics.com and use code DNA today for 25% off and free shipping. Again, that's picturegenetics.com with code DNA today for your Picture PDAware kit. Get actionable genetic insights today to benefit your family of tomorrow.
So APOE4, okay, we've known about this protein since the 1960s as well. And then in the 1970s, we found out that there was a mutation in it, and it was mostly related to cardiovascular disease back then. And so it wasn't until in the early 90s that they discovered, wow, people with this E4 mutation, or SNP, basically, so single nucleotide polymorphisms, had a higher incidence of Alzheimer's disease. So the APOE genotype has essentially two SNPs, like there's basically two protein changes, or two amino acid changes. It changes from a cysteine to an arginine. And what that does is it prevents, so an E2 carrier, so for all of you who don't follow E4 APOE genotyping in great detail, there's three genotypes. There's the E2 allele, there's the E3 allele, and there's the E4 allele. And of course, you get one from each of your parents, so there becomes six combinations. Most of us have the E3, which is the most common. So E3 is about 60-65% of the population. And then people have the E2, E3 is about, I don't know, 10-15%. But the E4s are about 20-25% of the population. So when they found this out, and they said, wow, there's a whole bunch of Alzheimer's patients that have this E4 genotype versus the others. And then so we said, well, what's going on with this thing? And it turns out that the E4s, they don't have cysteines. So those proteins can't form these little disulfide bridges. And that affects their ability to efflux cholesterol out of the cells. So the fundamental difference between the three different genotypes is their ability to efflux cholesterol. Then the story gets even more interesting because E4, so the E lipoprotein, it's a cholesterol transport protein, also is kind of cool. It's interesting because your LDL in your body is called ApoB. So you have these lipoproteins that transport cholesterol and lipids around your blood supply. And that's the one that sends cholesterol to all your cells on your LDL proteins. And then your cells actually suck that in. They tag on to that LDL protein and actually internalize it and then digest the cholesterol for your membranes. Then you have your HDL system, which people say, well, I want, you know, we'll say we want good HDL because that's your reverse cholesterol transport system. Now that's apolipoprotein A's, so A's and B's. And most of them, the HDLs do not go into your cells. When your cell is happy, it's got lots of cholesterol, it wants to get rid of extra cholesterol, it sends the cholesterol out via the HDL system, and then that trucks it back to your liver for clearance. So those two things balance your cellular cholesterol needs. The E type of lipoprotein is ambidextrous. It can be either LDL-like or HDL-like. So people that are born with a mutation in apolipoprotein B, like they don't make any LDL, they all of a sudden create a whole bunch of ApoE, and it acts like LDL in the periphery. That's what keeps them alive. Now, what makes E so unique is that it's the only apolipoprotein in the brain, 100% of the brain protein. It gets a little bit of A from your blood supply. So it is, the brain has all ApoE. The periphery has like 5%. So it's a minor player in the periphery, but in the brain, it's the whole thing. But it's different in the brain. It works, it does both LDL and HDL functions. So people think of, like, the brain has a different circulatory system. So in the periphery, you have your liver that's making a lot of cholesterol, and it's shipping cholesterol using an interstate highway system called your arteries, basically, all around the body, and it's sending it back and forth. So we ship cholesterol on big semi-trucks in the periphery. But in the brain, everything is local. Like, you're in Chinatown. It's like all these little streets behind each other. You can't even get a semi-trailer in there if you wanted to. So it's got a whole different purpose of transporting cholesterol from where it's produced, which is in astrocytes. So in the body, most of our liver is in the liver. Most of our cholesterol is in the liver, and the brain is in the astrocytes. And so the brain has to figure out a way, how do I do both LDL and HDL functions? Because cells need to be fed cholesterol, and they also need to be able to get rid of extra cholesterol. So ApoE, because ApoE can do both LDL and HDL functions, the brain uses it for both purposes, and it does it all locally. So what happens then is that the people with the ApoE genotypes now, that's why this has a big effect in brain. So if you're an E2 carrier, your cells are really good at effluxing cholesterol. They can't really hold cholesterol. They make it, they can spit cholesterol out of the cells very, very efficiently. And E3 carriers are, you know, it's like the three bears, basically. It's fine. And the E4s can't get rid of cholesterol very well. So they're cholesterol savers, if you will. And so when they make cholesterol in their cells, they don't get rid of it. And so now that's not a big deal when you're young, because ApoE is not the only system that your body relies on to distribute cholesterol. The other one is your membrane lipids, like plasmalogens. And these plasmalogens deal with cholesterol esterification, HDL cholesterol transport. And so they work like a yin and a yang in your cell membranes. And when you're young, you have lots of plasmalogens, your peroxisomal function is great. And in fact, when you're young, the E4 genotype is actually a protective genotype. It's good for you.
That's surprising, because we hear this E4 genotype as being like, oh, you have the bad one, or like you have the worst one. It's elevating your risk for Alzheimer's. So that's interesting that there's another side to that.
Yeah, it gives it protection. So for bacterial and viral infections, E4 carriers are somewhat protected from that because their cells are more resilient. Now, when you get older, what happens is your peroxisomal function decreases and your plasmalogen levels start going down. So the counterbalance to the ApoE HDL efflux starts becoming imbalanced. So you're running a three-legged race and your partner is just starting to get weaker and weaker. And what happens when you get older, with the plasmalogen levels decrease, then the balance is thrown off and cholesterol accumulates. And this is where the amyloid story comes in. So amyloid, which is normal, natural, okay, which is one of the main hallmarks of Alzheimer's pathology, is processed. Like, the precursor is a protein called amyloid precursor protein, APP. And so everyone's getting a really big biochemistry lesson here today. But if you're an E4 carrier, this kind of fun. Because what happens then is we get focused on the car accident, and we don't think about all the other cars that are driving by just super happy. So about 95% of this amyloid precursor protein normally gets processed by an enzyme called alpha secretase. And that doesn't create any amyloid plaques. Totally healthy, normal, go-lucky enzyme. It's only when the last little 5% gets processed by the enzyme called beta secretase that we get this amyloid plaque formation. Well, it turns out that beta secretase likes to be in the cholesterol-rich part of your membranes, and alpha secretase likes to be in the loose region. So it's kind of like one's in the ghetto and one's in the suburbs. And so when we, as you get older, the cholesterol levels of our membranes can get elevated. And so the region, the lipid raft region starts to expand. And as it expands, the number of beta secretase enzymes expands with it. So all of a sudden, your body starts creating more of this amyloid plaque. So E4 carriers have higher levels of amyloid in their brain versus non-E4 carriers. That's the biochemical correlate. And then that amyloid formation in the brain is actually a really good biomarker because it actually tells us that there's membrane dysfunction. It has very, very poor association with cognition, okay? Fundamentally, like if you correct for tau or other factors in the brain, cholinergic neuron density, amyloid no longer has statistical significance with cognition. But if you don't know those other variables, amyloid still becomes significant. So E4 carriers, on average, have higher levels of amyloid. But once you know the brain amyloid level, you do not need to know the ApoE genotype. So an E3 carrier with high amyloid is the same as an E4 carrier.
So you can bypass that part if you have the second part of that information, because the Correct. First part is really giving us a sense and giving us a landmark, kind of like, okay, where are we in terms of these risk levels? And you've been talking about these plasmalogens. If for people that have that E4 variant or maybe two E4 variants, can we elevate their plasmalogen levels so that we're giving them the same risk level exactly. as someone that genetically has a lower risk?
Yeah, you can reduce the risk. You can completely neutralize the E4 genotype. So E4 carriers with high plasmalogens have the same risk as an E3 carrier. Even more exciting is if you're an E3 carrier, if you have high plasmalogens, you have the same risk as an E2 carrier. And in our study, over 1,200 subjects, E2 carriers that had high plasmalogens, we found no cases of dementia in that entire population.
Wow, that is a big statistic you have there.
Right, and so it's a big number. And so what it means is that you can modify your genetic risk by changing the biochemistry. So if you're an E4 carrier, as long as your membrane structure is maintained the way you were when you're younger, you have no increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. And that's the kind of cool thing about biochemistry is once we understand the biochemical mechanisms of it, we can interact. Because like I said, genes aren't magic and biochemistry isn't magic either. Things are logical. I tell people, you know, no matter how fancy we get, we still can't get past the first law of thermodynamics, which is, you know, energy can't be created or destroyed.
Exactly.
Right? You know what I mean? So I tell people that, you know, look, your books are always going to balance. You may not like what you see at the end, but they will always balance. And so we have a lot of control over that. And so now we can restore plasmalogens. And we've done all this in the laboratory. And so if we do post-mortem brain analysis of patients, okay, and we look at the plasmalogens in the brain, people that have high plasmalogens in the brain have low levels of amyloid, regardless of their genotype. And then obviously the blood work does the same way. So we can measure that blood levels, and the blood levels correlate with people's brain levels. You know, it'll lag because you have reserve capacity and it takes a while to deplete them. So plasmalogens are one of those weird molecules. So it's one of those things where, like, I'm my background is in the biochemical mechanisms of disease, okay? And I studied it for years and years. I went to school for it. And after school, I studied it even more for 15 years. And so this technology, this biochemistry profiling technology that I invented in 1999, when we applied this to Alzheimer's, we saw all these molecules decreased in the blood of people with Alzheimer's disease. And they were weird. They had these seven oxygens or whatever, right? And it turned out they were plasmalogens. And I go, what the hell are these things? I had no idea what they were. And I should know because they're not trace level molecules. Like, we're talking 20% of your brain, you know, high levels of your heart, your lungs, your kidney, the retina of your eye, high levels of plasmalogens. Like, so it's not some trace level molecule that is just some real interesting sidebar to life. And children that are born with mutations in the plasmalogens, they don't live. Like, they're lucky to get to age 10, okay, with, you know, great caring parents. But it's a very, very challenging situation. And it turns out, so you think, wow, you know what? We've got these plasmalogens, so what's the big deal? They're high levels. We should be able to get them in our food supply. Well, the very last step in their manufacture creates this bond called a vinyl ether bond. And that is designed to be sensitive to acids. And because plasmalogens have three purposes in your world. One is it chemically neutralizes peroxides. So when you have oxidative stress and you have your cells start creating superoxide peroxide, so on, And then that's where you get your oxidized LDL and C-reactive proteins and so on. So plasmalogens that vinyl ether bond actually reacts with peroxides and neutralizes them. So I'll be presenting data on this at the Alzheimer's conference next month in end of July on how the relationship of blood plasmalogen levels after we supplement and elevate plasmalogen levels, the effect it has on your antioxidant system. So one part of plasmalogens is physical. It actually physically neutralizes reactive oxygen species, which is very different than like a vitamin E or a CoQ10. Like those are kind of hot potato holding molecules. Like you get an electron that's free, and these free radical scavengers, they'll pick it up and they'll hold it for a little while, but sooner or later they burn their fingers and they got to get rid of it because they don't actually neutralize the free radical. Plasmalogens actually blow up. They actually get consumed and sacrificed when they neutralize reactive oxygen species. So you make a lot of them, but you can consume a lot of them. And so one part is just actual at a chemical level, it does that. Then it has two other functions that are really important. One is membrane structure and relationship, like HDL transport, APO, the amyloid precursor protein, and all that kind of stuff, which you can talk about. But the biggest thing is membrane fusion and release of neurotransmitters. The most basic part of our brain and our neuromuscular junctions, like the human body lives in a lipid matrix, right? We're not a bowl of soup, you know, or a vat of beer brewing. We're separated by lipid membranes that defines us, and cell molecules go in and out of these membranes. But these membranes have to fuse with each other. And neurotransmitter release is you got a ball of neurotransmitters encased in a lipid vesicle. And when you want those neurotransmitters to be released in the synaptic cleft, they have to translocate and they have to physically fuse. It's an actual biophysical process of it's physical. And that process requires plasmalogens because this vinyl ether bond, you know, the physics of it says there's the inverse hexagonal phase, whatever. But these membranes fuse to let their transmitters release. If you have low levels of plasmalogens, you can't release neurotransmitters. So it reduces neurological transmission. And that's why we're seeing such powerful cognitive effects independent of anything else in people that are on the supplements. So that's one aspect. So those are the three main functions. And so the weird thing about them is that this vinyl ether bond, if you eat a nice juicy steak or an animal product that has plasmalogens in them, as soon as it hits the hydrochloric acid of your stomach, that bond bursts. So you must make your own plasmalogens. So we need a lot of them and we consume a lot of them. And so you have this mass balance equation. So at some point in time, when we're young, we build up reserve capacity and it's stored in our membranes, in our brain. And then if we get into a situation where we're not making enough of them, then the mass balance equation goes into the negative and you start losing them. And so the lower your plasmalogens, the faster your rate of decline is. And that's why when we look at blood levels, the lower the plasmalogen level, the faster the rate of cognitive decline is in people, because the plasmalogen bleeding out of the brain basically occurs faster and faster based upon the net balance. So you can improve them. And then, you know, in the historical way, you know, resistance training, like exercise improves peroxisomal function. So there's a lot of the things we talk about, cardiovascular and metabolic health and how that's linked to Alzheimer's disease, that's all real. Because your body is integrated. So anyway, so those are the big issues on plasmalogens. And it's a pretty cool story because it's one of those where you basically can't unsee it. Like once you see it, it makes sense. And it makes sense at the mechanistic level and also at the pathological level of where we're seeing things happen in the brain. And so that's what we do, one step at a time. We've been able to look at the postmortem brain analysis. Mortality is even more crazy. We have this longitudinal study we did in Chicago. It was 1,262 people. We tracked them over 6 years, and they're elderly. So the average age was in the 80s. So obviously during that period of time, certain number of people will die. And we have all that information and statistics. And so we were originally looking at the longitudinal effect of plasmalogen levels on the future occurrence of dementia. Can we predict who will get dementia based upon their blood levels? Okay. And then serendipitously afterwards, well, you know, we have this mortality data. Well, we should be looking at what is the effect of blood plasmalogens on, you know, all-cause mortality. And it turned out pretty severe. So a 30-year difference. severe, like the worst graph I've ever written in my life. So basically a 65-year-old with low plasmalogens had the same five-year mortality as a 95-year-old with high plasmalogens.
That's like shocking when you hear that statistic.
And that's after correcting for dementia. So dementia itself is high mortality. Like people think, oh, I'm going to get dementia and I'm going to live for 10, 15 years with it. No. The average time to death after a diagnosis of dementia is about 5 years. People can stay at home for a couple of years. Once they get into long-term care, it's usually a couple of years. You'll live longer with a stage 3 colon cancer diagnosis than you will with the diagnosis of dementia. Because it's serious. It's your brain health. And it's not random, right? By the time you have cognitive impairment, your reserve capacity of your brain has decreased. So you've been sick for a while, but just not knowing it, because our body has a lot of resilience. And so that's kind of where became quite shocking.
How do you keep research articles organized? I've struggled with this as a student for years, and now as a genetic counselor, I have so many papers saved on my Mac, but it's often hard to find one and even harder to cite when I'm writing. I finally found a solution, though. It's simple and easy. It's called PaperPile. The goal of PaperPile is to radically simplify the workflow of collecting, managing, and writing papers. This app allows you to highlight and annotate papers, manage references, share and collaborate, and get this, even cite directly in Google Docs. I wish I had discovered this when I was doing my thesis. It would have saved me hours of time and frustrations. At every step, PaperPile aims to provide a just-work solution that eliminates any unnecessary complexity. Especially with PaperPile's new mobile apps, you can sync your library to all your devices so you can read and annotate on your iPad, iPhone, or Android devices. So if you're a student, researcher, writer, really anyone who's downloading and reading papers, you gotta check out PaperPile for a streamlined approach. You can start your 30-day trial at paperpile.com with code DNATODAY. PaperPile costs only $36 per year, but with code DNATODAY, you save 20%. Again, that's paperpile.com for all your papers in one place. Nice and tidy. Intrigued about genetics? Of course you are. That's why you're listening to this podcast, which is why I think you'll be interested in an upcoming webinar on August 11th. In this 3-hour virtual workshop, a wide variety of genetic counseling topics will be explored, including prenatal genetic counseling presented by myself, precision medicine, overview of common genetic conditions, and more. Join us in this collaborative worldwide workshop next week on August 11th. You can register via the link in the show notes of this episode, which is also available on our website, dnapodcast.com.
It's also the biochemistry. People think on genetics that your genes give you this mortality risk, but what they do is they give you a disease risk. And then the disease is what kills you, not the genes. So APOE4 genotype have no increased mortality. So the only risk of death of an E4 carrier is those E4 carriers that become demented. But if you're an E4 carrier and you can avoid dementia, there's no mortality association with that E4 genotype anymore.
And so it's powerful to be able to take the supplement that you've developed, because you can bring up those plasmalogen levels so that you're decreasing the risk of all of these downstream effects of what you're saying, of decreasing, you know, of developing dementia from this.
Exactly. And then there's two types, like they're involved in two, I say proto-neuro, which has the DHA plasmalogen. I say you take neuro for performance, okay? Athletes, you want cognitive impairment when you're older, Parkinson's. But there's another aspect of plasmalogens. They also, if you have a different fatty acid on it, it doesn't have the long chain omega-3 DHA on it. If it has, say, the oleic acid, the omega-9 molecule, then it's part of your myelin sheath, the protective coating of your neurons, both in the brain with your white matter oligodendrocytes, but also in the periphery on your Schwann cells, like for ALS type diseases. And so glia is a product that we have that has the omega-9 plasmalogen. And we say, take glia for protection. So for concussion recovery, autism, reducing neural inflammation. So autism is a mitochondrial disease that's caused by white matter, hyperinflammatory disease. Same thing with multiple sclerosis. Multiple sclerosis is a neural inflammatory disease, and women will recognize their symptoms go away when they're in proesters, for instance. So an MS woman who gets pregnant, her symptoms will go away for most cases. And then later on, when they go into menopause, that's usually when they transition from relapsing remitting into secondary progressives, once they start losing the protective effects of estrogen, which is a very powerful neuroprotectant. So anyway, so those are the kind of things that you look at in terms of neurological health and understanding really at the basic fundamental, you know, building blocks and kind of working it from the inside out. Inflammation is just a good example. People think that you need to suppress the T cells or the activated microglia, but they're there for a reason. There's a chemoattractant signal that says, hey, there's a sick cell here. I better come over to it, give it the final metabolic death punch, if you will, and then clean out the mess. And that is typically oxidization of the membrane. And that's what activates this chemoattractant inflammatory signal. So if you can get into those cells at the beginning and prevent them from becoming oxidatively damaged, resolution goes away. And, you know, so we have this, you know, brain health is never just one thing. Okay. You know, there's always going to be one priority. Okay. There's always going to be the main shiny object in any given situation, if it's a stroke or if it's Alzheimer's or if it's Parkinson's. But once you get into it, all of these diseases have overlaps because, and then it becomes, what is your personal canary in your coal mine? Right. So if you apply a common stress to 100 people, you're going to get, I mean, not 100 different results, but you're going to get multiple different outcomes because each person now has their genetic predisposition. So your predisposition chooses your disease, doesn't really cause your disease as the most part. And so that's kind of and that's powerful because if you can understand the biochemistry of your personal genotype, then you can build an environment that your genotype is happy to live in. And then that way you keep it silent. And so that's kind of what I do. We basically do human biochemical engineering. And the plasmalogens are one part of that puzzle because you just don't want low plasmalogens. It's just not worth the risk. Yeah. And if you're an E4 carrier, it's just like it's a no-brainer. You need high levels of DHA plasmalogens just because, you know, you need to be ahead of the curve. And that's the whole concept of biochemical reserve capacity. And people think this is some strange concept, but it's not, right? The reason why you go jogging or you work out is to create reserve capacity. Like if you lift weights, and the goal is when you're not lifting weights. Okay, so the day that I'm not lifting weights and I'm just using my keyboard and my mouse, okay, I've created reserve strength so that I am operating on my days off under my capacity. So I've created reserve capacity. And say if you run or jog or whatever it is, you say, okay, now I can, on my days off, I have created reserve capacity. And that reserve capacity allows me to operate in a regular world at a very under capacity. It's like having a big savings account. If I have a heart savings account if I run, or if I have a muscular savings account if I work out. Well, biochemistry is the same way. If you can create like your methyltransferase system or your oxidative stress system, your cholesterol regulation system, these are biochemical systems. And we have reams of data, like lots of awesome, large epidemiological clinical data sets. Like we know what your optimal cholesterol levels in blood are supposed to be. We know what your uric acid should be. This is no longer ambiguous. Like all-cause mortality for all of these biomarkers are well established in very, very large numbers. And so our biochemistry is telling us what it wants to look like.
Yeah, it's, and there's literally screaming so much at us that you outline in the book too, of just with all the data you've gone through and everything. And I think we could keep talking about this for hours. I know, honestly, we just geek out over it, right?
But it starts making sense. And that's the other thing. People, like, your body is designed to work. Like if you can make it past your first year, you know, you basically have a sufficient genotype. Okay. If you have something so bad in your genotype that you've mutated, okay, you're going to know it. Okay. You're not going to have to wait till you're 50 to find out. Okay. Like you're going to know it very, very quickly. And now that takes more serious intervention, but a lot of those can be dealt with as well. But bottom line is, like, it's, we think that, you know, there's not this big 80-year ticking clock going on. It's an accumulated, you know, factors, but we can go into that in a subsequent conversation. But right, that's yes. But bottom line, though, people should embrace their genotype. Whatever genes you have, they're you. They're personally you. They're born when you're born. They don't know if you're going to be born in the United States or Somalia or Brazil, and so they have no choice in the matter. They have to live with whatever they're born with, and they learn to adapt to the environment just like you do. And so your genes are you. And the earlier people realize that, don't fight your genes, you know, work with them and find the happy space for them.
Yeah, certainly.
Better, better everybody will be.
So. Yeah. And people can learn more in the book we've been referencing that just came out this summer, Breaking Alzheimer's. We are doing a giveaway for 10 copies. So make sure to head over to our social media. Just search DNA Today on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, all of the places so that you can enter to win. And you can learn more at dnapodcast.com and also prodromesciences.com. And we're going to include links to everything in the show notes for this episode, which you can also access at dnapodcast.com. And if there are any questions, feel free to email into info@dnapodcast.com. Thank you so much, Dr. Goodnow, for coming on the show and just sharing all your expertise. It's so interesting to dive into how genetics plays a role in the dementia and all of the different aspects we talked about. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Did you know genetic changes account for an estimated 10 to 15% of all Parkinson's disease? And these genetic changes can be passed down to family members. That's why Picture Genetics just released their Picture PD Aware, an at-home DNA kit that tests for changes in the 7 genes associated with Parkinson's disease. Picture PD Aware is easy to order and understand with good-looking reports. Plus, you are fully supported through live chats, emails, and genetic counseling. To order your Picture PD Aware kit, use code DNA Today for 25% off and free shipping. Get actionable genetic insights today to benefit your family of tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Join us next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.